You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Democratic senators are proposing a minimum tax on large corporations in an effort to help fund their landmark legislative efforts. We'll learn about what the tax could look like and who it would affect. Now, you think you know pizza? Our next guest knows pizza to the tune of 1,700 pages worth of new book about the much-loved food tradition. On this edition of Food Friday, we're going to go deep on pizza. It's a food you can find, it turns out, all over the world in different shapes, sizes, thicknesses, toppings, and more. It's also personal. Most everyone has a favorite. It's comforting, nostalgic. It's also not always the easiest or quickest thing to make from scratch at home. You can join the pizza conversation at 800-642-1234. What is your all-time favorite? Do you make it at home? Do you make your own dough? How does it work out for you? Do you need some advice? Do you have a favorite style of pizza? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Francisco Magoya is head chef at Modernist Cuisine, co-author of Modernist Bread, and co-author of the new book set available this month. It's called Modernist Pizza. Francisco, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Well, this is an epic journey. Literally, you traveled thousands of miles in search of pizza and the history of pizza around the world. What led you and your colleagues to do this like encyclopedic look at pizza?
So it was a segue from our previous book, which we published in 2017, titled Modernist Bread. And in that book, we had covered a good amount of pizza. But I, believe it or not, it was a 5-volume book. We had to, it was going to be even bigger, and we had to trim some information out. And so, you know, that's when we thought about pizza as a good candidate for its own subject, deep dive book. And that's when we started, you know, thinking about it as a major project. So it was, you know, it follows the almost like a natural sequence of, you know, fermented doughs and so forth. Pizza has so many similarities with bread. I mean, there's a point where, you know, they do take different paths, but it just was a sort of born out of practicality and common sense.
You talk about the history. We could spend the whole time talking about that. I want to talk about the early days of pizza, and it's actually a pretty modern foodstuff, at least as far as a thing we today would look at and say, yeah, that's a pizza. When is the first thing in human history that we would say, yes, this is what we recognize as a pizza?
You know, the part of the problem with finding out when that exactly was is because this pizza, you know, pizza as we know it, was not really documented all that much, because it's always in its origins, it was always food for, you know, peasants, poor people. So, you know, academics did not bother all that much in documenting it or writing about it. So the first written source that we can find historically on pizza is in 1799, but it doesn't mean that it didn't exist before that. You know, as you know, whenever we do any sort of historical research, we have to go by what texts are available and what we can find. So that's as far back as we can go. But I think, you know, part of it also depends on what we define as pizza, because it's very hard to define precisely what pizza is. It's easier to define what it's not than what it is, because if we think it's a flatbread with stuff on top, there's so many things that could be considered that, right? You could go all the way back to Egyptian times and, you know, flatbreads that they made there. Is that pizza? I would say no. I would say that the cradle, the origin of pizza as we know it and all its descendants started in Naples in 1799.
Well, you spend a lot of time in history. You also have lots of recipes and practical advice. I want to talk about a couple key things here. Mm-hmm. As a home cook, I'm kind of like, yeah, this is close enough generally with the mm-hmm. things I cook. With pizza making, especially for making our own dough, I'm not going to mm-hmm. get away with that, right?
Well, the good thing is that there's many different styles that you can do, and they're all, you could almost categorize them by like super easy to make to very complicated to make. And I think that if I were to recommend a you know, pizza dough for a beginner, is what we would call thin crust dough, which is, it's a dough that it doesn't have to have like the big puffy crust on the sides. It doesn't have to, you know, ferment for a long period of time, and it's pretty easy to handle because it's not a very wet dough. So and it doesn't require a whole lot of time for fermentation, where a lot of people get impatient and they're not sure, right? It's like, is this ready? I don't know. I mean, you know, there are many questions that can come with if you don't have a lot of experience with it. So, but you know, there's different levels is what I'm getting at. And you can start very simple and then work your way up to the harder ones if you wanted to.
And I understand a key point that you hope we all take away is if we're going to get serious about making pizza dough, we want to weigh our ingredients instead of measuring them by volume. Why is that?
Yes, I think, and I don't think I know for sure that you're going to get more precise measures if you weigh them, because volume, I promise you, if you scooped 100 scoops of 1 cup of flour every time, you would have a different weight. Every single time, it would be a rarity if you had the same amount every time you dipped your measuring scoop into your flour, because flour it'll be either more compact or it'll be looser. It'll always be a different amount when you measure with volume. With weight, if you buy a $20 scale off of anywhere online, you're going to get precision. If you need 450 grams of flour, you're going to get 450 grams of flour, and it gets more important. I mean, it's always important, but with the smaller ingredient quantities, for example, salt and yeast, these are ingredients that are measured in very small quantities, and variations on those quantities can make a big impact. You have too much yeast, too much salt, or not enough salt, or not enough yeast. This is going to have a consequence on how your dough turns out. Where a volume measure is, again, it's not going to give you the same results every time. You might get lucky every couple times. One time it won't turn out. You might wonder why it is, and it's probably because your ingredients weren't properly measured out. So it's super easy. You just weigh all the ingredients into different containers, and then you're done. You know, I mean, I think that there's a simplicity that it's just we might be worried or concerned about it because we're used to volume. But once you start understanding, weighings and just how your product can come out consistently on a regular basis, that to me is worth the price of a cheap scale. So.
Talking to Francisco Magoya about pizza on this edition of Food Friday, co-author of the new book set out this month called Modernist Pizza. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your favorite pizza, or if you need some advice on making it at home. Timothy is on the line with us now in southern Minnesota. Timothy, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to ask about, Timothy?
Hey, Francisco. I think extending on the importance of weight, just wondering, you've traveled the world trying different pizzas and you've done a lot of lab experiments to understand what's important. Apart from like weighing your ingredients, are there other things that you think like at-home pizza chefs or professionals should be doing every time or thinking about every time in order to make better pizza?
Yes. Yes, there are a couple of things you can do. One of the biggest difference that you're going to have with your home environment versus a pizzeria is your oven. And while people might have specialized ovens, pizza enthusiasts of all kinds have, different ovens that they like, or they buy like these new outdoor ovens that are portable, which are great. But for the most part, the majority of people have just a simple home oven. And home ovens are practical, but they were built for doing many things, and none of which they do particularly well, because they work via heating the air inside the oven. So you open the oven door, and there goes most of it, right? So what I recommend is getting either a baking stone, or even better yet, something that's called a baking steel, which is made of steel. It's 3/8 of an inch of steel. I keep mine in my oven at home all the time. I don't even pull it out because it's so heavy, but also because whatever I use it for, it's great. So I keep it about 4 to 6 inches from the top of my oven, because that's where your oven is going to be hotter the closer to the top than it is in the middle or the bottom. So one of the things that pizza needs is super high heat. But also a baking steel, it absorbs heat really well from the oven. So all that hot air that is escaping, it's also going to make the baking steel really, really hot. But the steel is also going to hold on to that heat for a long period of time because it's a dense metal. And not only that, it's going to radiate it beautifully into your pizza crust. So it's going to give you a nice golden crispy base. It's going to bake your pizza a lot faster. And it really ups your pizza game tremendously at home. I think that's one of the best investments that you can make for baking pizza at home.
Thanks. Go ahead. Thanks for the call, Timothy. I want to bring on another caller now. Richard is with us in Two Rivers. Richard, hi.
Yeah, hi. How are you doing?
Good. What do you want to tell us about Richard?
I grew up, it's a trick question. I grew up in New Jersey, right outside New York, and they had really crappy pizza. But they sold it 25 cents a slice when I was 7 years old. And I'm going to give you some hints. What's the most famous? The question is, what's the most famous pizzeria in the world? And I'm going to give you more hints to see if you get it. It's in New Jersey on the Belt Turnpike, 7 miles from Manhattan, and it's on the Sopranos every trailer, and they showed the picture of it. And I was their first customer. I was 7 years old. I sat on their steps when they opened up.
Wow!
Because I wanted to eat the pizza. You know what it is?
Uh huh. Okay. So the pizza, the most famous pizzeria in the world, you're saying, is this one that was in the Sopranos series?
Yeah, they show it. People take pictures in front of it.
Richard, we got a break on him up. Could you spoil the answer for us, please?
It's called Pizza Land.
Pizza Land is the one in the Sopranos opening credits. Okay, thank you for that, Richard. I appreciate it. Francisco, he mentioned, you talk about in the book, you know, yes, we like really good pizza, but we might have a sentimental soft spot, like Richard obviously does, for that 25-cent a slice or buck a slice or whatever it might be.
Right. You know, I think that there is such a thing as, you know, having this nostalgia for foods where we had that we had when we were growing up that we think about as we're adults and we probably haven't had for a decade or two or maybe three or even more. And we create this like nostalgia around it that it's like, oh, no, this was the best thing we ever had. And then we go back to it as adults after having experienced the world and tasted different foods and, you know, refined our palates a little bit more. And we go back. And it's this huge disappointment. It's not the pizza that has changed. What has changed is you. Mostly because nostalgia plays a big part in what we think of as, you know, the best pizza back home or when we were growing up and so forth. So it's a very interesting phenomenon. I think the most important thing, the biggest takeaway is that if it was something that you're nostalgic about, just don't have it again. Just keep it as a memory because you might be disappointed.
I love it. We're talking to Modernist Cuisine head chef Francisco Magoya about his new project, a massive 4-book series out this month called Modernist Pizza. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you need some home pizza making advice or just want to share a favorite? 800-642-1234 is the number to call. Find some recipes for some Detroit style pizza that Francisco shared with us over at WPR.org/Food Friday. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our Food Friday talk with Francisco Magoya, head chef at Modernist Cuisine and co-author of the new multi-volume book set, Modernist Pizza. You can join in with your pizza questions at 800-642-1234. Francisco, before we go back to our callers, you shared some recipes for making Detroit-style pizza, crust, sauce, and toppings. We've got them online at WPR.org/Food Friday. I grew up in southeastern Michigan. It turned out I grew up eating Detroit-style pizza. I didn't know to call it that. What do we mean when we say Detroit-style?
So the most, I guess, the most important characteristic, well, there's a couple, actually, of this pizza style. But the first is that it's baked in these rectangular pans that were... They're actually made of black steel. They were used in the automotive industry. They were used as oil pans. And I'm not exactly sure who had the brilliant idea of actually using that to bake pizza, but it is a brilliant idea mostly because the material that they're made of is very good at keeping its shape. So if you put it in a really hot oven, it's not going to warp or bend or twist. And because it's black steel, it gets your dough hot very quickly. And so it gives you like a nice crispy base on your pizza. But the other important characteristic of Detroit style pizza is the cheese that goes on top of it, which is Wisconsin brick cheese. And so Wisconsin brick cheese is, its process for making this cheese is very similar to cheddar. It's cultured with a very similar culture, but it's actually at a higher temperature. So it produces like a tangier cheese. It's a higher fat content. The structure itself is, the protein structure is a little bit different. But it has a butteriness and a richness that other cheeses don't really have. And so when you bake it, you know, for those who are not familiar, this cheese is basically spread on the entire surface of the dough, and it comes in contact with the pan. So when it bakes, it has this like golden crispy crust around the border of the pizza, which is absolutely delicious. And this cheese has also like a, I would say like a buttery taste to it, a richness that is, it has a similar, to me, it reminds me of butter. So it's like crispy butter, cheesy goodness around the crust. So if you don't have, the only problem with this cheese is that it's hard to get if you're not, I guess, in Wisconsin. So yes, you guys have an edge over everybody. But if you don't have that cheese, cheddar is the next best choice to utilize for this particular style of pizza.
Let's go back to our callers now at 800-642-1234. We've got Paul on the line in Eau Claire. Paul, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you want to tell
us about?
Love
your show, Rob.
Thanks.
I just wanted to pass along that being from Chicago, everyone assumes that our favorite pizza is a deep dish, but the vast majority of Chicagoans really prefer a thin crust with excellent ingredients,
you know, right,
from the dough, the sauce, right, the cheese. And it's interesting that everybody says, oh, you must love the deep dish, but right, I think it's quite different. That's
yeah,
all I have.
No, and he makes a really good point. That is something that we did learn early on, that if you ask somebody for Chicago, or if somebody from Chicago says, let's go and get pizza, they're not referring to necessarily deep dish. For the most part, they're talking about a thin crust, which is one of my favorite pizzas. It is one of my preferred textures and, you know, the toppings that go on top of it, et cetera. And it is true, but people, when they think about or speak about Chicago pizza, they usually go directly to deep dish. And there's heated debates typically when it comes to whether it's pizza or not. But
thanks a lot for sharing that, Paul. We'll go next to Beth with us in Milton. Beth, hi.
Hi. Hey, thanks for taking my call. And your guest just mentioned, you know, the brick cheese making the crust and everything tastes buttery. But there was a fantastic restaurant in Milton where I live called Giorgio's. They're no longer there, but I always thought they had the best pizza, and my husband always said they were overrated, but their crust was buttery, whole milk cheese, everything was just perfect. And then after all of our arguments, the USA Today named it the best pizza restaurant in Wisconsin. So I won that argument.
You win, Beth. That is awesome.
Good for you.
Thanks for that. That said, Francisco, I guess, you know, it can be subjective, right?
Sure. I mean, I think that there's, I love a Detroit style pizza, and I will also enjoy a Neapolitan style. And, you know, they're so different. It's like, would you prefer an apple or an orange? And I think that sometimes you prefer an apple and sometimes you prefer an orange. And it's not a cop out. I think it's more that there's such a breadth of variety and styles that it's very hard to say, you know, one is better than the other, or that, you know, one you like and one you don't like, at least for me personally.
Thanks for sharing that, Beth. We'll go next to Joe in Eagle River. Joe, hello.
Hi there. I had a question. I've been making pizza for years at home with the dough, and I saw something on the internet from an Italian guy, and he suggested adding a quarter of a cup of dry white wine to the we use scalded milk that's been cooled with the yeast before we grow it, you know. But it does really seem to change the texture of the dough. I can't remember the explanation for it, but have you ever heard of doing that?
No, I think that the best thing you can do with that white wine is drink it instead of putting in your dough, mostly because I think from what I hear, you're using active yeast, active dry yeast to get the yeast going, because it typically requires a hotter liquid to, I guess, start the fermentation process. But if I could recommend, you know, typically when you use milk in a dough, it makes for a softer dough because of the lactose in the milk. So my suggestion is just use instant yeast instead of active yeast, and then you can just room temperature water. It'll bloom the yeast without any problems. And I think that that would make a much better dough. I think the wine in the dough is just, it's, I'm not sure who the chef is, but I wouldn't recommend it.
Joe, thanks for that call. I got to ask you, Francisco, I feel like if I'd eaten as much pizza as you did all over the world, you know, at restaurants, stuff you made yourself, I feel like I'd be done with pizza for a while. Did you hit a stage like that?
Yes, there is such a thing as too much pizza. As we were wrapping up the project, I was like, I don't want to see another pizza for a few months because it does get to that point. But I think I'm at the point now where I love it again. It's something that I know that I don't have to be analytical about it all the time, and I can just enjoy it.
So if I said, Francisco, you got to eat a pizza this weekend, you know, it doesn't have to be your all-time favorite, what pizza would you go for?
You know, I think if for an experience, I would definitely recommend Neapolitan style. It's so different from what we get in the United States, unless it's a Neapolitan style pizzeria. But it's very different. It's, you know, cooked very quickly, 60 to 75 seconds. It's a really good experience, and that's what I would recommend.
Francisco, we'll leave it there. Thanks so much for sharing all this pizza with us today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you very much for having me.
That's Francisco Magoya, head chef at Modernist Cuisine, co-author of the book Modernist Bread, and co-author of the new book Set we've been talking about. It's available this month. It's called Modernist Pizza. 4 books with the history and science and techniques, and yes, lots and lots of recipes. Join us for Food Friday to share some of that extensive advice. And you can get recipes to make pizza yourself over at WPR.org/Food Friday. Detroit-style red top pizza. Find the recipe for the dough, the sauce, and, of course, the critical Wisconsin brick cheese that goes with it, all at WPR.org/Food Friday. Make some. Let me know how it turns out. Coming up Monday at 8 on The Morning Show, meet the creator of a project that shares stories about people who are in the prison system to help them make a successful return to their communities after their release. Find out more. That's Monday at 8 on The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. If you need some scary tourism this weekend, you may be in luck in Wisconsin. An online website of reported ghost sightings puts Wisconsin 14th in the nation in the number of reports. That's not broken down per capita, so as the 23rd biggest state, we have more than our share. The same site lists Janesville as the most haunted city in Wisconsin. A lot of that comes from ghost reports involving a local cemetery, which the operators of that cemetery point out is not really all that scary. And just this month, the travel site Only in Your State recommends a driving tour of places with ghost reports, including the Pfister Hotel in Milwaukee, the West Cove Lanes Bowling Alley in Ladysmith, and Kemper Hall in Kenosha. Here's another scary tradition. Every year around this season, a group of visitors comes to Wisconsin from Illinois to confront their fears at one of the most frightening places they've ever encountered. It's not on Halloween. The Chicago Bears play at Lambeau on December 12th this year. Scary news you can use. This is Central Time. Listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network, I'm Rob Barrett. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, it's the Friday News Roundup. A coup in Sudan, world leaders gather in Rome, also what to expect from talks that have been described as the world's last best chance to avert a climate crisis. That's today at 6 on 1A+. Now, a trio of Senate Democrats earlier this week released a proposal to institute a 15% minimum tax on large corporations. By large, that's businesses reporting annual profits of more than $1 billion at least 3 years in a row. This is another plan aimed at raising revenue to help pay for President Biden's Build Back Better agenda and the big spending plans Democrats have been negotiating. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about how corporations currently handle taxes? What impressions do you have about the taxes larger companies pay, whether they contribute fairly compared with individual taxpayers, or maybe with smaller businesses? Do you have thoughts about the idea of requiring a corporate minimum tax? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Thomas Kemp, is professor and department chair at the UW-Eau Claire Department of Economics. Tom, welcome back to Central Time.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here, Rob. Thanks for having me.
From what you're seeing from Democrats here, what are we talking about with this idea, this concept of a corporate minimum tax?
Yeah, so there's a lot of moving pieces in all this, as I'm sure you and all the listeners appreciate. So it's not quite clear exactly how this is going to all plan out, but as it stands now, the call is for a, as you mentioned, a 15% corporate minimum tax on incomes for corporations earning annual revenues more than $1 billion. It's not clear at this point what specific deductions and write-offs, you know, may creep into that over the next hours and days, but that's where we are now. So the idea would be that, you know, that all firms of size would have to hit that 15%.
Can you talk about the discrepancy between what we hear argued about a lot, the corporate tax rate and the effective tax rate for corporations? Why is that not the same number?
Yeah, so the tax rate would be the rate on paper, right? So I have income of a certain amount, and that slots me into a certain income tax category, like you know how households have with their income tax. But then, of course, there are a variety of deductions and write-offs that firms can take, as well as a number of other strategies that can reduce their tax obligation, which then gives us the effective tax rate, or the rate of taxes actually paid against revenues earned.
A lot of people point toward loopholes in the tax code that allow corporations to do that, but one person's loophole might be another person's tax incentive, something introduced to have a certain outcome. Is it possible to sort out what we would call a loophole from a policy choice?
Well, that's a difficult thing to do, because, as you say, loophole is a pejorative term we use to identifying tax policies that we don't like. Interestingly enough, in the broader Build Back plan, there are a number of tax incentives for shifting to, say, green manufacturing and green energy. Undoubtedly, those will, if they pass at some point in time, also be called loopholes in the tax policy. So it's really important to I think get away from the pejoratives and to start think about tax policy in terms of what we're trying to achieve as a society. Do those so-called loopholes achieve goals that we want to try to achieve as a society?
We're talking to Thomas Kemp, professor and department chair of economics at UW-Eau Claire, looking at the idea of a corporate minimum tax. It's one of many ideas on the table in Congress right now as part of the revenue side of spending plans from Democrats. You could join in with your questions, your thoughts on the idea at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Tom, I think a lot of people look at this and think about the headlines you hear from time to time. Big corporation X paid X amount, zero amount of taxes in a particular year. How does that end up happening? Is it something that you think we should be worried about when it does happen?
Well, it happens for a variety of reasons, but the most common reason is they're taking advantage of loopholes, dare I say it, in the tax code. If they can effectively reduce their taxable earnings to zero, then their tax obligation is zero, of course. And you know, to a large extent, those laws exist for good reasons. They may have been historical reasons or current reasons, but you know, as a society, we put them there in place. And so, you know, if we feel that as a society that corporations aren't paying, you know, what we think they should pay, you know, that it may be time to start looking at what some of those deductions are or other possibilities that allow them to reduce their taxable earnings.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Andrew is with us in Whitewater. Andrew, hi.
Hi there. I just had a quick question on the constitutionality of adding another direct tax to businesses. Given that the Constitution states that in order for a direct tax to be applied, that it has to be apportioned, I wonder how the Congress will amend the Constitution to allow this, or how they plan to get around the Constitution on this issue.
Andrew, thanks for the call. Now, with the idea of a wealth tax, I've heard constitutional objections raised. Tom, have you heard anything like that about a corporate minimum tax, though?
No, I have not. That said, of course, you know, it's the legislative branch's mandate to pass laws, and then if there are objections to those laws on constitutionality bases, then it's up to the judicial branch to reach that finding, right? And so they're the arbiter of whether that's the case or not. And I suspect, right, that with this bill, and as with most large bills, there are many tests of its constitutionality, and that's how the system's supposed to work, right? So legislators legislate, and then the judicial branch makes sure, you know, keeps everybody in line, make sure we're following the other laws that we've set for ourselves.
Thanks for the call, Andrew, at 800-642-1234. Looking at this criteria, 3 years in a row with $1 billion revenue, that's not your garden variety corner store. What kind of companies do we know would be affected, Tom, under the plan as it currently stands?
Yeah, that's right. It isn't. So, you know, I'm concerned, I'm sure, that many people have, you know, that you know, you'd be hitting very small businesses with very small margins with these additional taxes. And you know, those firms that are, you know, under $1 billion in revenue, so $1 billion in revenue, right? So break that down into a, you know, you're talking, you know, millions daily, right? So these are going to be quite large firms that are hit with this, you know, so your Apple Corporation, your Ford Motor Company, your Google, so on and so forth. Not the corner grocery store.
I know there are concerns sometimes about unintended consequences when we make a change in the tax code. We haven't tried this corporate minimum tax idea yet, but do you see any possible unintended consequences of setting this this floor for a corporate minimum tax?
Yeah, I think it's vague enough at this point in terms of what's been said. It's hard to know. I think that's extremely likely that you know, we're going to end up seeing a whole bunch of deductions into this, right? So it isn't going to be, you know, just 15% on $1 billion and up, and that's going to be the end of it. There's going to be a variety of various incentives and other loopholes, again, dare I say it, written into this. That's probably where our objections and unintended consequences are going to come from.
We're talking. Oh, go ahead.
No, that's it. Thank you.
We're talking to economics professor and department chair Thomas Kemp from UW-Eau Claire, looking at a proposal for a minimum corporate tax. It came from a trio of Senate Democrats, part of the effort to help pay for their infrastructure and social spending bills. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is fair to you when it comes to corporations and taxes? Do you think big companies should continue to be able to take advantage of credits and incentives and other opportunities in their tax code to pay a lower effective tax rate? Do you want to see this minimum corporate tax in place or not? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk with Thomas Kemp from UW-Eau Claire, talking about the prospect of a corporate minimum tax, how it would work, the effect it could have. It's on the table, at least right now, in Congress. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Do you think that big corporations pay their fair share in taxes? What would a fair share look like if so? Do you like this idea or not? Call 800-642-1234 with your thoughts or your questions. Let's go back to your calls now. Jeff is with us in Central Wisconsin. Jeff, hi.
Good afternoon. Thank you for having me.
What do you want to bring up, Jeff?
Well, I don't want to beat a dead horse, as I mentioned, coming into the conversation, but I mean, this proposal has been visited many times before, and it solves all the problems, every single problem we have with taxes. The billionaire's tax, the millionaire's tax, the corporate tax is a flat tax. It's a simple concept. It solves everything. It's simply the more you spend, the more you're taxed. Rich people spend a lot more than the guy on welfare. So if you have a situation where you're out buying things, you will be taxed for it. Simple. I don't understand. I know it has been addressed. I don't know why it's not being implemented.
And I just want to be clear, Jeff. A lot of times when people say flat tax, Jeff, they're talking about a percentage of income. You're talking about a percentage of sales, of consumption here. Do I have you right?
Percentage of consumption, correct.
Gotcha.
Whatever you spend, you're taxed on.
Jeff, thanks a lot for the call. Tom, what do you think? Consumption taxes, I mean, we have sales taxes. Could that be the basis, though, for a wider system of taxation?
Well, as the caller mentioned, it's certainly been proposed a number of times to have a wholly consumption-based tax. Like with any proposal, there are some pros and cons associated with those types of taxes. I hesitate to start a lecture on what those may be. Suffice it to say that one challenge to those types of taxes is that, as the caller mentions, obviously people of means tend to buy more things than people of more modest incomes. But of course, people of more modest incomes also spend a larger portion of their income on consumption goods, right? So rather than, say, investment goods. People of more modest incomes are generally spending virtually all of their income in consumption, and thus virtually all of their income would be taxed. Whereas people of more significant means have the ability to store away some of their income in a variety of forms and would thus be able to avoid that tax. So the problem of people of means avoiding taxes has always been with us and will likely always be with us.
Thanks for that call at 800-642-1234. Tom, I've seen one argument in favor of the corporate minimum tax going along this kind of lines. Big companies have an unfair advantage in some ways over smaller companies because they can afford the best accounting and legal minds to help them avoid taxes. The mid-sized company, you know, maybe they've got okay accountants. The smaller company, the owner is the accounting department.
Yeah.
Does this make a more level playing field potentially for businesses of different sizes?
Yeah, I think I'm not sure if that will end up being the case, but I think that it's pretty clear that that's one of the goals that's trying to be achieved here. And that, you know, that's a real thing, right? If you're a small business, you know, it's just a struggle to keep on top of all these regulations and tax codes. You know, whereas if you're a $1 billion enterprise, you have a team of professionals that that are out there working on that problem every day. And so that does create the possibility of some real inequities. Whereas if you sort of created, you know, this sort of thing where it's a sort of additional tax or an additional minimum tax really on really only larger firms, you know, potentially you get away from some of those inequities.
An argument against sometimes any tax increase on wealthier people or corporations is that, well, they're just going to find another way with those fine accounting and legal minds to avoid these taxes. Do you think that's a reason to not pursue this kind of thing?
Well, I'm going to try to stay away from what my opinion on is on these things. I have an opinion. I think that taxes are a question of what society wants. So how society wants to, where it wants to get money from for public purpose and how it wants to spend that money on public purposes. And so to the extent that we're having a discussion about who should be taxed and how they should be taxed, I think that's a positive thing for everybody and for our society. And that's what I at least see going on here to some extent.
We're talking to Thomas Kemp, professor and department chair in the UW-Eau Claire Department of Economics, looking at the idea of a corporate minimum tax. It is one of the ideas on the table among Democrats in Congress, looking for ways to pay for it, to offset at least some of the costs of their infrastructure and social spending packages. You can join in with your thoughts or your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go now to David on the line in Deerfield. David, hi.
Yes, hello. How are you?
Good. What do you want to bring up, David?
You know, just thinking about the corporate taxes and the people who don't pay taxes, corporations that can give the Republican Party a couple of years ago $450 million, but they don't pay any taxes in Beloit, Wisconsin. And my point that I thought about is when people are involved with a corporation where they have a hold of a lot of money, you know, CFOs, CEOs, COOs, whoever they are, and think about it. They say, gosh, I'd like to have a rocket that I can charge people money and will go in orbit, just, you know, around the Earth. Think about when those people are saying that, do they think about the people that put $4 worth of gas in the tank of their car because that's all they can afford that time? Corporations should be paying more. They should be paying something. And when you see corporations that can finagle their way out of paying anything, I'm old enough that I remember the Silverado affair with the savings and loans. And there were people who stole hundreds of millions of dollars, and 200 wasn't enough for somebody. The next person stole 300. The next person stole 400.
I gotcha. David, thanks a lot for the call. Now, David, thanks for calling in. Tom, Pew Research shared results of a survey in April this year that showed a lot of people, I think, are on a page with our caller. 81% of Americans said that corporations don't pay their fair share. At least this perception here is out there, Tom, that, people do want to see corporations pay more.
Yeah, I think that's a fair thing. Boy, you know, you look at those numbers that you cited a little earlier about large firms and them not paying any taxes, and you know that gets my blood up a little bit, and I'll bet you it gets, well, Pew Research suggested it gets a lot of people's blood up, so I can certainly understand that. I mean, the challenge with this thing is that, you know, for larger firms, it's relatively easy. I don't mean to say it's zero cost, but it's relatively easy for them to move earnings overseas. Right? And that's one of the significant ways in which they're able to reduce their tax obligation. And of course, the federal government has, you know, very limited authority, you know, when we're discussing overseas activities. And so some of this conversation that we're hearing around this about, you know, global minimum tax, as well as, you know, the Biden administration has thrown us out there. A couple senators have been discussing these ideas. It's been a challenge for a long time to try to get some of the larger firms to pay taxes because of the relative ease of which they can avoid taxes. And so, you know, to me, if we think of ideas of taxes, sort of this social discussion, right? The fact that we're sort of beginning to start seeing a global discussion about what corporate taxes should be, I think it's going to be a while in coming, but it's at least the beginnings of starting to think about how we can stop this, right? So we can stop this sort of race to the bottom with corporate taxes and large business entities.
Thanks for the call, David. We'll go next to Tom in Milwaukee. Hi, Tom.
Hi. As I hear the corporate tax, I think our party is confused, because the corporations, when they are taxed to 15%, the corporation is simply going to pass on that expense to the consumer. And what happens with the consumer is that the wealthy consumer won't have a problem getting 15% increased taxes on their bread or on their food or on their cars. That won't bother them. But the middle income and the lower income people will be punished by it. The same thing has just happened as gas prices have gone up 50%. And the people that are wealthy, they don't care that they pay a little bit more for their gasoline. But the people that are middle income and the people that are lower income that are trying to get to work, they're being crushed by these kind of taxes. So
I gotcha. Tom, we don't have too much time left. Tom Kemp, the idea that you raise a tax on a corporation, well, we end up paying for it anyway.
Well, it's true. I mean, some of taxes are going to be passed on to the consumer. However, in most markets, not 100% of that is going to be passed on to the consumer. It takes certain market irregularities for a firm to be able to pass 100% of a cost on to a consumer. So we shouldn't sort of think of this as a complete zero-sum gain. Does it produce the, you know, sort of are the on paper results exactly what ends up happening? No, it's more complicated than that. As you mentioned, I think most people are of the opinion that, you know, these taxes should be raised. And again, it's about what society thinks should happen in the whole.
Tom, thanks for the call. And Tom, thanks again for joining us today.
Yeah, thank you, Rob. Always a pleasure.
That's Thomas Kemp, professor and department chair in the UW-Eau Claire Department of Economics. We talked to him about corporate minimum taxes, like the one being produced by a small group of Democratic senators. Coming up Monday here on Central Time, climate change could lead to increased threats to communities on Great Lakes coastlines. Wisconsin has a lot of those. We'll find out what's at stake and how people are responding. Voting policies are getting a close look in Wisconsin, in the legislature, and in the race for governor. We'll look at questions over the ways that people deliver absentee ballots and how people in nursing homes can vote. And we'll visit a little free library in Green Bay that's spreading art instead of books. That's coming up Monday here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, a pediatric infectious disease specialist explains the ins and outs of the Pfizer COVID vaccine for kids from 5 to 11. That was just approved by the FDA today. It still needs CDC approval. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.